The state Senate is debating a sweeping police reform bill this afternoon after several procedural delays last week. Among the proposals, limits on the use of force by law enforcement, changes to what's called qualified immunity for police officers, and the creation of a new independent entity to certify and decertify officers. Shortly, we'll have an update on the debate live from the State House, but first, what do police officers think of the bill? We're joined by the president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, Larry Calderoni. He's been on the Boston Police since 1994. Thanks for taking the time to join us today, Officer Calderoni.
I appreciate the time. Thank you very much for having me, Ms. Deering.
So I'd like, Officer, to start with the big picture. What sparked this current push for change was the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police in May. I want to start by asking for your reaction to that incident, and do you think this is a time for policing reform?
Well, I'll answer both questions. Thank you. Let's start with the horrible actions that took place in Minneapolis. I've said it time and time again on different shows and being questioned. You don't have to be a police officer to know what happened in Minneapolis is horrible and wrong. Luckily, in Massachusetts, we haven't experienced anything close to this, nor do I think we will. We are extremely well-trained, very well-educated, and again, it's a tragedy what happened out there, and we should not be painted with the same brush here in Massachusetts as they are in other parts of the country. But it was a horrible act.
So do you feel that by pursuing police reform here in the Commonwealth, that the police officers here in the Commonwealth are being painted with the same brush as those in Minneapolis?
I don't think that the legislation itself is painting us with the same brush. I look at it from a different standpoint. This is not the first conversation that's happened on Beacon Hill with so-called police reform. I'm formerly the legislative director for the Patrolmen's Association, and I was working on Beacon Hill on matters such as this. I look at Massachusetts, Boston specific, but I will go on the record for the whole Commonwealth. I believe that Massachusetts has the best policing in the country. And I know everyone says that, depending what geographical location you're speaking in. But I make that claim after being a police officer for 25 years. And I work side by side with the best men and women that policing could exemplify. And when I talk about police reform, as good as we are, there's always room for improvement. And that's the message we've been carrying on Beacon Hill, not only in the last several months, but in the last several years, again, in my time up there as the legislative director.
Us about that. What is the room for improvement? What improvement do you see room for among officers and in policing reform?
Well, I look at some of the current requests from the Black and Latino Caucus. If you don't know, my organization, for the first time in its history, had a closed-door meeting with the Black and Latino Caucus from the legislature a couple of different times. They were very constructive. And what we did talk about were some uniform standards and training guidelines for the entire Commonwealth. And that's not a bad thing.
You talked about the fact that you don't want police in the Commonwealth to be painted with the same brush and that the things that happened to George Floyd haven't happened here. How do you square that with the number of people who were repeatedly in the streets in Boston saying that they had a different experience with police officers in the Commonwealth, police officers in Boston as well, and that reforms were necessary for them to feel safe and to trust law enforcement in their communities?
Well, I'm not going to second guess how numerous people in the streets are classifying their interaction with the police officer. I could deal with them on a case-by-case basis specifically if I have knowledge of them. But I'll say this, if people felt that they had a negative experience with the police officer, then there are avenues to discuss that. There are avenues to proceed with complaints. But you mentioned the people in the street specifically over the behavior starting on May 31st. I would tell you that there is a prime example of how well-trained police officers are in the Commonwealth. We had to ask for mutual aid from surrounding communities all the way through the state police and the National Guard. And it's the first time that I think we can proudly say that even to this day, with all of the standouts and protests that we're used to in Boston dating back through the 70s, this is the first time that I don't recall or having anybody bring to my attention any protester that went to the hospital claiming police brutality. And that is contrary. We had 9 police officers in Boston that night that needed to be hospitalized. So zero on the protesters' side would tell me that police officers did an outstanding job in light of what was happening that night, from rocks and bottles and these makeshift cement bottles that were being thrown at us, fireworks, etc. Everybody knows what happened. And I think the men and women that night did a great job.
So a couple of things there. Just I want to be clear that here on Radio Boston, we've been careful to distinguish between peaceful protests that happened on the day that you're talking about and an outbreak that happened in the downtown crossing area that night. In addition, I'm anxious to move on to the legislation, and we've covered the protests extensively here on Radio Boston and WBUR. So let's turn our attention here to the legislation today. I want to ask you, what pieces, I know there are a couple of serious concerns from the Patrolmen's Association about the bill. We'll get to those in a moment. Before that, I want to ask you, are there pieces of the bill you support and want to see advanced?
Sure, there are. And you'll have to forgive me, as I know there's 72 pages worth of material there. But we agree to some of the positions that are in the bill. We understand, like I said, the uniform standards and training guidelines that they want to put forth. We understand the request for the what's called the POSIC board. That would be an oversight panel made up of non-law enforcement personnel and law enforcement personnel. They would be charged with the duty of coming up with these standards and these guidelines. They would work with the Massachusetts Police Training Council on coming up with different educational matters on many different topics that would be uniform across the Commonwealth. We support that. We support pieces in the bill that talk about non-discharging weapons at moving vehicles, where there's excessive force material, there's a duty to intervene material, there's language about increased diversity throughout police organizations in the Commonwealth. We agree with all of those topics. It's the few pieces that seem to be of greater concern to us that may be costly to law enforcement and the general public as a whole. That's
my understanding. Sorry, Officer Calderoni, we've got a little delay, so sometimes I'm interrupting you without meaning to. My understanding is that the two places where the rubber really meets the road on this bill for the Patrolmen's Association is the certification process for officers and also the qualified immunity adjustments that are in the proposed bill. Am I correct that those are the two sticking points primarily?
No, I apologize, Tiziana. The one about the certification is not a concern of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. Currently, we are trained through the Boston Police Academy. We follow the guidelines of the Mass Police Training Council. We are all certified and licensed through the City of Boston when we graduate from the Police Academy. The certification process that would be put in place by the panel still has a ways to go, and I would call that a work in progress, not only with the Black and Latino Caucus and our organization, but also the members of the Senate, members of the governor's office, the governor himself, and members of the House of Representatives, which will be taking that up next. You are
and
correct.
I apologize. I meant to actually talk about the certification board. I do understand there was some concern about what the legislation proposes for the makeup of the board. I apologize. I misspoke.
Not a problem. That would be correct. So why don't I do this? Why don't I tell you the three topics that are of concern? Because you did have qualified immunity as one of them. Due process,
yes,
the other, and the makeup of the panel would be the third. Those are our three focuses of concern at the moment.
And what is your concern on the makeup of the panel?
The makeup of the panel that came out of the governor's office, again, was non-law enforcement and law enforcement. In the governor's version, it seemed to be a little too top-heavy on management. There were 7 non-law enforcement seats, and there were 7 law enforcement seats, 6 of which would be considered management. And that was concerning to us, because when you're creating a panel that's going to set standards, guidelines, trainings, have investigatory power to certify and decertify, when you're talking about an overhaul of the public safety system and policing as we know it, who better to be involved in those decision-making processes than the offices that represent the men and women on the street every day that are answering these calls for service? It would be crazy.
Officer, as I understand it, As the legislation is written now, the board will be 13 members. Six of them will be in law enforcement. The rest will be nominated from organizations like the NAACP, ACLU, Massachusetts Black and Latino Caucus, et cetera. So what in that makeup are you seeking to see changed?
We're seeking to see change on the management side, on the law enforcement side. On the non-law enforcement side, we believe that it should be experts in the field. And although we know we're not going to be in charge of who is going to be named to the panel, we believe we should be treated just like all other panels for certifications and decertifications. When you look at physicians and lawyers, nurses, teachers, those panels that oversee those professions, those are all experts in the field. More than 70% of the physicians panel or the attorneys boards that oversee attorneys, more than 70% are experts in the field. Surely we're not going to decertify a doctor or a lawyer made up of a bunch of community activists or people that are not professionals in the field. Why would policing
Officer,
be any different?
What of the pushback that the situation here is different because this panel would be put together during a time of reform and therefore would need more people who have been affected by previous history and have more voice than we might do if we were not enacting a certification and decertification panel during a time of reform?
Well, I would actually think that we'd be putting this panel together on an unbiased point of view. We would be looking to decertify and take police officers off the street that don't belong there. Let me share with you that there's nothing worse for a good policeman than a bad police officer. Nobody wants to work next to a bad police officer. But again, we want to take an unbiased approach. I would not want to put a panel of overseers in power that had a poor experience with a police officer or have some hidden bias as to why they want to make a decision. Just like doctors and lawyers oversight panels, we want experts in the field to take an independent, educated approach as to the facts of the case. We don't want people that had negative experiences in the operating room that are going to come and judge the physicians as a whole. They're obviously going to be biased in their opinion. So again, why would we judge police officers any differently?
We're going to have to go soon, and I want to make sure before we do, Officer, that we get to concerns about qualified immunity. Just for our listeners, that's the legal doctrine that shields government officials, including police officers, from being civilly liable or from being sued for actions taken on the job, except in extreme circumstances. And this bill would limit that qualified immunity so that officers would be shielded, quote, only if, quote, no reasonable defendant could have had reason to believe that such conduct would violate the law, end quote. I understand you think these proposed changes are too strong. Are you open to some change to the status of qualified immunity here in the Commonwealth?
So it's interesting that somebody would say that I think they're too strong. Let me go on the record as telling you that I have never given that opinion or that quote. My issue and the issue of police officers I represent is that qualified immunity is an extremely complex judicial doctrine that even the legislators themselves don't understand. I've been working the phone for the past several days with members of the Law Enforcement Policy Group. That group represents 16,000 uniform officers and correction officers across the Commonwealth. It's a very large group. And we've been calling virtually every senator that will take our call. And each senator has a different understanding of what qualified immunity actually does. And as we explain to them that it's been developed over the last 30 years throughout the court system, it's been appealed, it's been granted, it's been appealed, we get different answers depending on different judges and different levels of court systems that you go through. But yet our legislature, even though they don't understand it, wants to hurry up and pass a bill in the next several days, changing qualified immunity as we know it, and they cannot be articulate and correct on whether or not it will have a better effect, a worse effect. Is it going to hurt the general public? Another falsehood that people don't understand, probably people that are listening to us right now, is that qualified immunity actually exists and was put in place to protect from false litigation and false claims against municipalities and all public employees. I stress all.
I want to stop you there, Officer, because I want to go back to the first part of your point. We had a representative of the ACLU of Massachusetts on our air last week talking about qualified immunity, and he said that The way it has played out, it is tantamount to complete immunity for law enforcement officers from civil liability. Is that appropriate? And any understanding of the concern? I mean, this is qualified immunity is being pushed back on all over the country right now, at the federal level, at local levels, in different states. Do you understand the concern and the pushback that that level of shield can breach trust and also put citizens potentially at harm?
Well, I can understand that level of security, absolutely, because right now the only officials that I'm aware of in the Commonwealth that receive absolute immunity, as you say it, are judges in the courtroom, DAs in the courtroom, and the actual legislators themselves. It's the elected officials up at the State House that actually enjoy absolute immunity. Qualified immunity, again, is only granted by the judge when a public employee, it's not only for police officers. This is for all public employees, the town assessor, the building inspector, the nurses, the doctors, the teachers, people that work throughout our entire society for municipalities or government. Those are public employees, and all of them.
Although certainly the town assessor doesn't have the same kind of power and immediate sway, for example, that a law enforcement officer does.
See, so that's the misconception that's being brought out there, is that the actual assessor, he is granted or she is granted qualified immunity by the judge when they're acting as an agent for the government that employs them. And again, it shields them from financial burden as well as the community that employs them. This is not something that shields a bad police officer. Qualified immunity only affects a police officer in the court when they are acting within the scope of their duties. If they violate the law, if they commit a felony, they are not granted qualified immunity. And contrary to what some of our Congress people are actually saying publicly, qualified immunity does not stop you from suing a police officer. Police officers are sued when they do something wrong. It happens, unfortunately, because every place has officers that do things wrong, and all professions have people that do things wrong. And if we violate the law as police officers, we're charged criminally, and if we're found guilty, like every other citizen in the Commonwealth, we go to jail and we pay the penalty. We're not granted qualified immunity.
We are out of time. We're actually, in fact, way past our time. I just want to let listeners know we're going to have a legal analyst, WBUR legal analyst, Judge Nancy Gertner, to kind of walk us through how the law works on this tomorrow, and we will keep following this story. I appreciate your time today, Officer Larry Calderoni, the president of the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Daring. Appreciate it. Thank you.
And again, listeners, we will continue to follow this story. We've been speaking with activists making the case for change. Today we heard a police point of view. We will continue to bring you perspectives as this story unfolds. Right now, we want to get some quick reaction and the latest from Beacon Hill, where WBUR Senior Statehouse reporter Steve Brown is. Steve, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
Not too bad. Been watching the Senate here on my little TV screen. They're in a little recess right now. Maybe they took a pause to listen to the show. I don't know.
So what have you been seeing, Steve? Yeah.
They are now moving forward here. They're starting to go through the amendments. As you know, they were hoping to do this on Thursday to try to get through this bill. And, of course, the big sticking point, there are disagreements on a number of different things, but the big one is this qualified immunity, which Officer Calderoni was talking about, you and he were discussing, and that seems to be the big hang-up. The supporters of the reform movement seem to think that having removed or lessened so that a police officer could be charged civilly if they're found to be breaking the law is a key component of this bill. The police unions last week urged their members to call the Senate and to support amendments that would soften that language. So there was the 3-day hang-up there where they used parliamentary procedures to stop the debate. So the debate was supposed to be on Thursday. They put it off to Friday. It didn't happen Friday. They put it off to Saturday. And now finally we're here, and it is starting to move forward. They haven't got to those meatier amendments yet. There, I believe there are 7 amendments that would change the way the law is written about the qualified immunity.
Steve, did you hear, you heard Officer Calderoni just now on air. Is he making similar arguments to what you're hearing state senators make on Beacon Hill? And what has the tone of that debate been today?
Sure. The tone, they're getting back to being their usual collegial self. A lot of the debate didn't take place. The debate was taking place behind closed doors and in caucus. And I've heard that this was a big wedge issue in the Senate. The members don't like to be on different pages on things. They like to pass consensus bills where basically the tally is lopsided, 39-0, 40-0. They like everybody to be in agreement. They're not going to be there on some of these amendments. Some of these amendments are going to be very close. And I think, I was hearing from the senators, they were quite upset about the fact that they were having such strong disagreements over this. Senator Dean Tran of Fitchburg spoke earlier today to that.
We have in front of us a divisive and politically driven piece of legislation aimed to divide us even more. Look at what it is doing to this Senate and imagine what it will do to our state.
So again, like I say, the senators really pride themselves in getting along and not being split on things. And this was tearing them apart over the weekend. It seems from what I'm hearing that the votes are going to be close on some of these amendments, but the fact that they're moving forward with it indicates that they may have the votes to approve the amendments that would make those changes to the qualified immunity.
So, Steve, early last week, supporters of this bill said they wanted to pass it by the end of the week, last week. You're saying sure. That there's some movement today. Is this a bill that is going to pass in the state Senate? Do we know?
I think it will pass in the Senate. They definitely will come up with something. The fact that they're starting to move through this today, I'm hearing that they do want to get it done and get it done today. Time is of the essence here because they have to get everything done by July 31st. They have to get it to the governor's desk. They'd actually like to get it done sooner than that in case the governor issues a veto or suggests some amendments or things like that. They still need to build in that buffer if there are any changes that the governor might make, that they can go back and either uphold it or override it.
And then, Steve, what comes next? I mean, there are several steps in getting a bill passed and making it law, and time is running out.
Yeah, I'm hearing that probably in the next couple of days, we will be hearing a version from the House. They will come up with their version. Of course, last month, the governor put out a version. Now this is the Senate's version. And then we'll be getting the House's version. They will go through it. I'm hearing it's going to be a little more watered down than what the Senate is trying to do. So you're going to have 2 different versions of the bill. There will be a conference committee. And the way things work around here, that July 31st deadline, and sometimes they use it as a cudgel to, it's this or nothing. You got to go with it. You take it or leave it. They use that date, that cutoff date, as a way to force the other branch to concede to that. So what happens in conference remains to be seen. That'll probably play out the last week of July.
All right. And that is WBUR Senior Statehouse reporter Steve Brown. Steve, we'll look forward to talking to you again. I know we're both going to, our show and you are going to continue to track this. Thank you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
When the Commonwealth's contact tracing initiative was announced, it was to be a key strategy in our overall coronavirus response. As the state has successfully reduced the spread of COVID-19, it's begun scaling back those efforts. The program has reportedly also faced criticism from some communities about its efficacy. So, Where are we on contact tracing, and do we have the system we need now and down the line? Joining us to talk about that is John Welch. He's the Director of Partnerships and Operations for the Massachusetts COVID Response Project at Partners in Health. Welcome back to Radio Boston, John.
Thanks so much, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
So Partners in Health collaborated with the Commonwealth to stand up and operate this contact tracing initiative. Has it worked, and how do you know?
Yeah, we continue to partner with the Commonwealth and local health departments to provide contact tracing backup and support for those health departments. And, you know, I think we're in a moment in the pandemic where if we look around at other states, we see those numbers kind of surging, not kind of surging, really surging. And in Massachusetts, we've reached a manageable transmission rate that's been relatively stable. And I think that's a good indicator for us that contact tracing, along with all of the other components of a public health response, including testing and supported isolation and quarantine, have been effective here.
So, John, as you say, there are a lot of components to the Commonwealth's response that have gotten us to the numbers that we're at right now. I want to comb out a little more clearly. Which part of that is contact tracing supposed to achieve? And how do you know you achieved that part?
So the role of contact tracing in any epidemic response is to break the chains of transmission or spreading of that infectious disease. It is quite difficult, as you can imagine, particularly in the midst of an ongoing pandemic, to really tease out which of those things have been most successful. But you will see that in other locations that have not invested in and worked so hard to build contact tracing teams or invested in more ubiquitous testing and things are really struggling right now. So we know that reaching a majority of cases and contacts and giving them the tools that they need to stay safe at home while they're isolating or quarantining are really, really important measures to any sort of epidemic response. And I think in Massachusetts—
So according to— let me ask you about that. So
yeah,
according to the Globe, last week data provided by the state indicated that the collaborative is engaged with a total of 47,000 people out of 55,000 people it has attempted to reach, which is an 85% engagement rate. What was your target engagement rate? So, and you know, so where does 85% fit against that? I'm just, again, trying to kind of get a sense of the metrics that you're using to know if and how this is working.
Yeah, so as with any public health intervention, one of the most important things early on is educating the public. And you know, while contact tracing is something that's happened long before the Community Tracing Collaborative by local health departments and will continue to be carried out by local health departments when COVID is through, part of the endeavor during an epidemic or a pandemic is to teach the public about what all these different measures are. So you can imagine early on when cases were surging here in Massachusetts, there was also an effort to teach the public about what contact tracing is and why it's important for them to be involved. And I'll say over the last 6 weeks, we've actually been able to reach over 90% of individuals that test positive for COVID within the first 24 hours of those cases being sent to the Community Tracing Collaborative.
And is that kind of the threshold you've been wanting to achieve?
Well, I think all of us would like to reach every case and every contact. And though that's a difficult endeavor, we've gotten better and better at it all the time. And you know, to that end, a lot of that improvement has come through learning best practices from various health departments and public health nurses around Massachusetts who have needed the backup and the support of the Community Tracing Collaborative, but also have been really quite helpful in leading the way and teaching us how they have found success as well.
So let's talk about the scaling back. According to Globe reporting, at this point, that sort of the capacity is reduced from 1,900 staff members to about 700 staff members. Our numbers are also dramatically down. This is, however, capacity we may need at higher levels again. One could imagine a layperson saying, wow, that is a huge reduction in the number of staff, pretty steep cuts. How do we, is it too much? And how would we scale up again rapidly with those kinds of cuts if we get a second wave or if surges from other states start to spread here in the Commonwealth again too?
Yeah, I think it's one of the great things about the model for contact tracing here in Massachusetts. And that is that the scalable workforce is exactly that. The community tracing collaborative is very flexible and scalable. And, while trying to be responsible with taxpayer dollars and also let the epidemic drive the response. So we have a reserve of individuals who've indicated to us that they would be willing to come back and be redeployed urgently if necessary. Our training team has training packages together to update those individuals and bring them back on as quickly as possible. And, we continue to work very closely with DPH and make sure that the Community Tracing Collaborative is fully scalable and ready to respond according to the epidemiology.
So John, we only have about a minute left, and I want in that time to ask you, there have been reports of some local health officials who have been frustrated with communication and data. I'm particularly concerned about Chelsea, which has been a hotspot and disproportionately affected, and being frustrated about some of the data they haven't been able to get. Where are you in working with Chelsea? Just very briefly, please.
Yeah, we actually have a wonderful relationship with the local health department there in Chelsea and work very closely. We've been able to assist them and support them in contact tracing and a huge number of their cases. And certainly all the time we're working to improve that support. Public health accompaniment is a constant project to improve communication and provide as much support as the local health department needs. And we're here. And I think we've served Chelsea well, and we'll continue to work really hard to support them in whatever it is that they need us to do.
All right. And that's John Welch, the Director of Partnerships and Operations for the Massachusetts COVID Response Project at Partners in Health. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you.
We want to give you another opportunity to ask your coronavirus questions to a panel of Boston doctors. You can call us with those questions at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So joining us now to take those questions is Dr. Benjamin Linus, an infectious disease physician and associate professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Boston University School of Medicine. Dr. Linus, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Happy to be here.
And also joining us is Dr. Sandra Nelson, an infectious disease physician at Massachusetts General Hospital and an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Nelson, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
And we are going to jump in just a second right into calls because they are coming in fast already. But I did just want to turn to the two of you for a minute. With cases, this is the New York Times, with cases surging in California, Governor Gavin Newsom has announced that he is going to roll back the state's reopening plan, saying today, he's talking about closing indoor operations statewide. That means restaurants, wineries, movie theaters, zoos, card rooms, bars are going to be forced to close their doors entirely. That is an interesting moment because California seemed to have been ahead of us a while ago and then seemed to be doing better. And now, of course, is in the thick of it again. How are you feeling about where we are in phase three? Dr. Linus, why don't you go first? Because you've been with us on this off and on since March.
Sure. I mean, I think it's upsetting news. I think it's probably shouldn't be surprising that this virus is circulating in our communities and no degree of shutdown will eliminate transmission to the point that if we go back to old behaviors and prior COVID sort of things that we do, the virus will come back until such a time that we have an effective vaccine and or effective clinical treatment. This virus is with us and we're going to have to, I think, be addressing it off and on throughout the time.
And Dr. Nelson, let me give you a chance to react as well.
I agree with Dr. Linus. I think it really points to the need for a cautious reopening. I think what we've done a little bit differently in Massachusetts relative to California is we've been slower in opening up segments of society. And I think we've been fairly attentive to some of the social distancing and other measures to keep things slow. But I do think we need to take every lesson from states around us and think about them as we contemplate how best to reopen. And I think it also provides good evidence that opening needs to be in both directions. We need to be able to open things up, but we need to be able to close them if trends move in the wrong direction.
All right, Drs. Linus and Nelson are ready for your calls. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's start with Nikki in Framingham. Nikki, what's your question?
Hi, yes. I recovered from COVID-19 on May 17th. And so, but I heard about a couple studies from China and anecdotes in California that the antibodies are not necessarily lasting very long. So I guess I'm just curious, is it worth having antibodies tested? Or obviously I'm just being as cautious as everyone else as if I didn't have it. But so I'm just wondering if it's worth getting antibodies tested, and what does this mean for vaccines if the antibodies go away so quickly?
Thanks for that, Nikki. And I'll turn to our experts. Who would like to answer that one?
I can take a first shot at that. I think it is true. We've seen that antibody titers decrease over time. But it's also true that the straight antibody titer does not necessarily correlate with immunity. There's other diseases for which the antibody titer might be unmeasurable. But if you're re-exposed to that pathogen, your antibodies spring back to life. That's one of the powers of our immune system. The truth is we don't really know yet what antibody means towards immunity. And so what I've been telling patients with whom I work is that it's good to know your antibody status. It can be helpful for public health purposes and for your own curiosity. But the danger is that I would not change my protective behavior based on my serology status. Just because you've had COVID, we don't know for sure if that means that you can get it again or what it means to future transmission. So keep up your guard.
We saw some reporting recently, and I'll get you the source on it in just a moment, of a physician saying that they had a patient who was essentially infected twice, and the physician did not believe that it was just a resurgence of the original coronavirus, but they actually got it twice. What do we know, Dr. Nelson, about whether or not that happens and how much of a risk that is?
I think that the reason that this is even discussed is because the test that we have measures viral material, but it doesn't measure live virus. And one of the things that we've noticed is that some individuals can continue to express some of that viral material for long periods of time, even when they're cured. And they can continue to have positive tests for weeks or months. And sometimes those tests are intermittent, meaning that they'll test positive, then they'll test negative, and then they'll test positive again. It's hard to know without knowing the clinical context for that setting. There are some inflammatory conditions which can follow an episode of COVID, which may mimic the original illness to a sense. But obviously, there are many other illnesses as well that look a little bit like COVID, other respiratory viruses. And so it's plausible that someone might have had an infection with COVID. It cleared. They continued to have a positive test, and yet their symptoms were due to another problem. So I don't think we have any really good evidence right now that in the short term we are seeing recurrences. But as Dr. Linus mentioned, we don't know what the long-term immunity is.
Okay. And just Vox.com was the source of that article. Let's go to another call, 1-800-423-8255. We've got Martha on the line in Lakeville. Martha, go ahead.
Yes, my question is, you hear on the media that testing is available for all and that you'll find out the results. My daughter's been sick and it was very difficult to get her a test. I was finally able to. And 6 days after, I'm still waiting for results. Why is that?
Yeah, Martha, that's frustrating. I'm sorry. And I hope your daughter will be okay. Dr. Linus.
I share your frustration. I can't answer you why that is. I think that I can say that the root cause for that is that we don't have a national strategy to roll out testing and contact tracing to control this epidemic in the United States. And that's a symptom of the fact that there's no strategy and there hasn't been for 5 months now. I share your frustration that now in June, it's still difficult to get a test. And even when you do, the turnaround time is effectively it's not workable. That's too slow to really make any meaningful decisions. And it's a problem that we really need to keep addressing, because I don't see how we can control the epidemic without really having real-time information as to where we are. We're effectively flying without instruments. And you can see the result in the resurgence of the epidemic around the country.
Let's take another call, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Alex on the line from Lancaster. Alex, what's your question?
Hi, thanks for having me. I wasn't sure, with all the information coming out regarding, clotting being one of the main causes of issues as a result of COVID, is there a chance that, mild, like one glass of, say, wine or vodka could help thin the blood enough, even if in unsymptomatic carriers? Could that help at all?
So, Alex, are you concerned about blood clotting? Is that your question?
Yes, that seems to be the issue.
Let's turn to Dr. Nelson. Thanks for that question. What do we know about concerns about blood clotting, Dr. Nelson? And if so, is there anything one should do about that preventively?
No, that's a really great question. We do know that clotting is one of the complications of the inflammatory illness that goes along with COVID, and particularly patients who either have underlying risks to clot or those that are hospitalized are higher risk of having blood clots. We don't in general recommend any preventative treatments for outpatients who are doing well, and particularly outpatients who have no symptoms of their infection. That just really hasn't been studied, and there are risks with any of the antiplatelet agents or other medications that are taken to avoid clotting. Certainly alcohol has many other effects, and I think the interface between alcohol and COVID is also not really well known. So I don't think right now anyone would recommend that as a specific means to prevent clotting. But it's important to note that that is an issue that's been seen in the patients who do get very sick with this.
And listeners, we were talking about testing a minute ago. Just so you know, we have a link to the Massachusetts Interactive Map of testing locations on our website at radioboston.org for your reference. Dr. Linus, you wrote an opinion piece saying that, it's complicated, but you are in support of returning to school in the fall. There is a lot there. But one of the things that you talk about is what we do and don't know about transmission with kids as carriers or spreaders. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure, happy to. I know Dr. Nelson has a lot of expertise in this field as well. The article was really focusing on the fact that we really have to make a decision about schools. We have no choice. We have to either reopen or not reopen, and either one of those things is a decision. And so really what we're looking at now is being forced to make a decision with uncertainty, which is uncomfortable, but something that we have to be prepared to do. And I argue that if you're making a decision under uncertainty, the best that you can do is to look at the data that are available and use them to make an informed decision while acknowledging that you could be wrong and being prepared to act quickly if you are. So that's what I propose in the article. And the data that I was referring to are data that are emerging from around the world. First, that it seems pretty clear that children, when they are less likely to become COVID infected than adults, and also that when they are infected, they have a much milder form of the disease than adults do. Further, if you look around the globe, there's not really clear evidence that schools are playing a major role in driving transmission in the community. I think that, frankly, is uncertain. I'm not ready to bet the farm on that finding. And so that's why in the article, I propose that if we're going to reopen schools, that effort needs to be coupled to school-specific strategies for getting kids and staff tested and having the results come back not in 6 days, but within a day, such that it's an actionable time frame to do something and prevent another a cluster of transmission in the school. I think that's something that is feasible for Massachusetts, but would certainly take a lot of political will and a dedicated effort. And that's something that we're engaged with now, trying to move forward and affect change, because I do think that there's real harm to keeping schools closed. And the last thing I would say is that it is easy to cite back scary statistics that some children could die if we reopen schools. Of course, that is an absolute tragedy, and no one wants any children to die. I think that when reflecting on those data, it's also important to acknowledge the risks and the harms of not reopening, because those are real as well. And ultimately, we have to come to the right decision balancing those two things. I'm not going to stick my neck out right now and tell everyone what the right decision is. But I do think whatever your thoughts are, you have to acknowledge both sides of the decision because it's a hard one.
And we will actually have further discussions here on Radio Boston. You know, school reopening is a big issue, and we will continue to follow it and have further discussions here. Dr. Nelson, we had a caller who got disconnected, and it was an interesting call. The caller said, I have been trying to find out whether or not coronavirus can be transmitted through cigarette smoke.
That's actually a really interesting question. We do think that that you can blow viral particles through other, through, for example, wind instruments. However, there's filters within cigarette smoke. And some of the evidence thus far suggests that smokers may not actually be at higher risk compared to other well-established risk factors. I don't know if the answer to that is known, but certainly chronic underlying lung disease is a risk factor for doing poorly with coronavirus. And so it's certainly not anything that anyone's going to advocate as means of prevention.
Thank you for that, Dr. Nelson. And I guess as we wrap up, my question is, we know the long play is a vaccine, and we know there are even concerns about what vaccination rates will achieve and how effective a vaccine will be. So there's so much still left unanswered. For each of you, what is the most important next thing for us to be focusing on here in the Commonwealth? Dr. Linus.
Well, I think at this very moment, the most important thing to be thinking about is schools in the fall. I think that that's perhaps it's because I'm a parent, and so it's really preoccupying my thoughts, but I don't think I'm alone with that. And it's a major decision we need to make. It's a decision we need to be making right now. And it's also now is the time for putting new infrastructure into place for things like school-specific testing strategies. So in my mind, that's the question today.
And Dr. Sandra Nelson, what do you think?
You know, I share the overall sense that school reopening is really where our primary focus needs to be. And I would balance that by saying that really the best way that we can achieve a safe school reopening is to continue to keep our rates of transmission in the community low. And so to the extent that we owe it to our children to get them back to school, I think we need to put all of our other activities in the context of how will that affect the likelihood that we'll be able to get them back? And will we be able to keep the rates of transmission in the community low? Masking has been shown.
I'm going to have to stop you there, Dr. Nelson. I'm so sorry. We're just the show's out of time. That's Dr. Sandra Nelson, an infectious disease physician at Massachusetts General Hospital, and Dr. Benjamin Linus, an infectious disease physician and professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Boston University School of Medicine. Thanks to both of you.